The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Well, we've got a real Scott on hand tonight, and you'll pardon me if I leave the accent up to the genuine article. I'm speaking of Irvine Welsh, of course. Yes, he's the author of Trainspotting, but numerous other novels, too, like Trainspotting's sequel, Porno, and, of course, Filth and Glue, among others. I learned quite a few things about Mr. Welsh today via the internet, especially via suicidegirls.com, which featured an interview. Some of the things I learned, his career as a TV repairman was cut short due to an electric shock. He once fell 30 feet from a fire escape on his 20th birthday. He's a big fan of late 70s punk, especially the London punk scene, and he has a birthday coming up. His new novel does indeed feature drugs and sex, but Mr. Welsh has added a hint of pedophilia to the mix, this time, with crime. Crime is a bit of a companion piece to Filth in that it picks up on Inspector Ray Lennox's story. The novel begins with Detective Lennox taking leave from his stressful position with the Edinburgh PD, a mental break and holiday in Miami. Things become everything but restful and leisurely-like. Engaging Irvin Welsh this evening is David Ulan. David Ulan is book editor of the Los Angeles Times and author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith, and the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology, which won a California Book Award. He has written for The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, The New York Times Book Review, The LA Weekly, Los Angeles Magazine, and National Public Radio's All Things Considered. Duh. As usual, our program this evening will conclude with a Q&A session, and a little different tonight. Mr. Welsh will read a bit, and then from the podium, and then it'll be followed by the conversation. After the program tonight, we'll have a book signing in the lobby, so please join us. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you please join me in turning off our cell phones and in welcoming Irvin Welsh and David Ulan to the Los Angeles Public Library.
All right. Do you want to read from the podium first, or do you want to talk, or...
Yeah, I'll read if it's okay.
Okay, yeah, why don't we? We're just making it up as we go along.
Great stuff. I see a guy in a hip strip there, which is different class. Well done. The thing about this. This character, Ray Lennox, is probably one of the most sympathetic characters I've written about. And he isn't a hip supporter, he's actually a heart supporter, which kind of was a bit painful for me. But as he was a heart supporter in the first book, Filth, I had to continue in that vein. Justin's actually set up a nice introduction for me, because he's gone off the rails, he's had a breakdown, he's with his girlfriend in Miami. They're planning the wedding, but unfortunately, he's had a bit of a sort of a drinking binge, and he's fallen out with his girlfriend, and they've gone their separate ways basically. And what he's done is he's gone off on a kind of drinking cocaine binge, and he's met these two women in a bar in Miami Beach, and they've gone back to one of the girls, Robin. They've gone back to her place. So Robin and Starry are the two women, and Lennox has gone back to their place. So here we go. Starry has set up the drinks. Miller's all round with vodkas and Pepsi, and she's racking out more lines of cocaine on the coffee table. More is good, First law of consumer capitalism. Second law, immediate is all. Lennox feels a binge coming on. Starry catches the hunger in his eyes. Go on, Scarry. Her mother is coquettish. He's about to test his more constricted vent when a young girl wearing a nightdress appears in the doorway of the room. Her skin is a tawny contrast to the paleness of her mother's, yet the girl still cuts an almost spectral figure. Brown hair hangs down the sides of a longish face onto her shoulders. She rubs sleep from her eyes in a very obvious theatrical manner. Shamed, Lennox immediately ceases his activity and stands up. "Hi, I'm Ray," he says, getting in between the kid and the stuff on the table. "To Anna Marie Hinton, you get back to bed, young lady. This is growing up time," Robin declares in a panicky voice. He can envisage one of the women in the South Beach real estate commercials privately deploying, perhaps after hearing of a market slump. All the time she looks at Lennox with a stupidity teetering between sheepish and bovine. The kid glances at him for the first time. It's a cold look, appraising rather than judging, but referencing that he's something that she's seen before. Something not good. It dawns on Lennox that she's been alone while they were cavorting at the Club Juice and Myopia over in Miami Beach. It wasn't right. Kids shouldn't be left alone like that. Little Brittany Hamill should never have walked to school alone. He feels anger rise in him and fights to swallow it down with a gulp of his beer. All the time, he keeps his frame between the girl and the table. As she's distracted by her mother's ministrations, Lennox places a copy of Trudy's Perfect Bride magazine over the white stripes, catches Starry sneering at Robin again. "I couldn't sleep," the girl says. "I heard you guys coming in." She looks at Lennox again and nudges her mother, seeking confirmation. "This here's Ray, honey. Ray's a friend from Scotland." "Where men wear skirts," Starry laughs. "Right, Ray?" "Right." Lennox practically ignores her, focusing again on the young girl. Her arms and legs are way too long for her body. Her hair is a scraggy mop and she seems all angles, a kind of ungainly ugly duckling. But her eyes, he catches a brief glimpse of a terrible knowledge in her eyes. For a second, Lennox has a sinking sense that they're asking the world for help. Then it's gone, and she's just another tired kid, short-changed in affection, security, and sleep. "Y'all get yourself off to bed now, you hear, honey?" Robin says, as the girl lopes away, mumbling and waving a cursory goodbye without turning round. As she leaves the room, Starry changes the CD and turns up the volume as Cuban music fills the air. Lennox's knowledge of this genre stops and starts with the Buena Vista Social Club, which he'd seen with Prudy, who bought him the CD. But this music is nothing like that. With its poignant beats, sweeping strings and muted brass, it's the saddest stuff he's ever heard. Although with Spanish vocals and purporting to be Cuban, it somehow feels like it's been made locally, perhaps in this very Miami neighbourhood. He stifles the temptation to inquire about the artist. He'd be relieved never to hear its terrible beauty again. Fitfully, he worries about Trudy. What will she be doing now? In the hotel room, indulging in one of her two pathetic responses, worried sick, or not giving a fuck, perhaps occupying both states simultaneously. "Ah, this is fucked," Lennox whispers, bouncing down on the couch in melancholy laughter before Starry shimmies over and drags him back to his feet. They dance together a little before Robin moves in. The women are being sexy. Lennox thinks speculatively about threesomes. Isn't that what he needs to feel his masculinity again, extremis? It worked the last time job and drug could combine to cauterise his body and soul. But a nasty current now hangs between Starry and Robin. They're harshly and nakedly competing for him, grinding closer, suggestive eyes expanding with need, their mouths tight with aggression. He thinks about yesterday at the torpedo club. He feels Robin move into him, her arms reaching up around his neck, hanging from him like a charity shop suit in a reckless bid to shut Starry out. Then the doorbell buzzes, and while he's aware that more people have appeared, Lennox feels his nostrils, even as he bubbles with snot, filling up with the scent of Robin's hair. The buzz of the coke works in a square throb with the beat, booze and jet lag. A wave of exhaustion, almost breathtaking, hits the back of his eyes. Letting them close for either seconds or minutes, he watches the exploding purple blotches swirl around in the universe inside his head. Then he feels Robin pull away from him. He opens his eyes to be confronted by a lined, ashen face with short grey hair plastered back over the scalp, gelled and spiked enough to see the comb lines. It belongs to a thin white man, yet who looks wiry and strong, and his ophidian eyes burn Lennox, and he notes Robin too. The proximity moves him to take a backward step. Then he sees a denim shirt tucked into jeans of the same material. Looks down at brilliant white trainers, or on this side of the lock, sneakers. Nodding curtly at Lennox with a smile so slight, it would have needed a moving camera to record it. The newcomer says to Robin in a lo-fi country accent, "You been out shopping again?" "This here's Ray," Robin replies apologetically. Already Lennox scents not only history, but unfinished business. "Name's Lance, Lance Dearen. Pleasure to meet you, Ray." He grins, extending his hand. Lennox strategically takes it in his good left, despite the awkwardness, relieved he's presented that one, due to the power he feels in the grip in closing it. "You gone busted a mitt there?" Deering asks, nodding to his dangling right. "Industrial accident," Lennox boldly retorts. But Lance Deering can evidently read the trepidation on his face as he calmly says, "Don't you worry none, Ray. You ain't stepping on no toes here. We all been round the block enough times to know to take our pleasures where we find them. No questions asked. Ain't that right, gals?" Starry's pearly teeth flash, her brows arching like a corporate fast food executive who has sold face as well as soul to the company store. Robin smiles weakly, dutifully pouring some drinks for Lance and the other man present. He's squat and stocky, Latino, with collar-length oily hair and a sandpaper chin. His gaze at Lennox is one of undisguised hostility. "This here's Johnny," Lance smiles. "You gotta be the guy from out of town," Johnny says in a scratchy voice, looking Lennox up and down. His head seems way too big for the features squashed ungenerously into the middle of it. His big slaughterman's hands look formidable. Along with the dense body and shifty eyes, they suggest a man prepared to take what he wants without expecting much in the way of debate. The notion is countered by a flabby gut strinning at a t-shirt bearing the slogan, "We'll fuck for coke." "I don't think he's the same guy you're thinking of, Johnny," Lance grins at Lennox. "But I do hear that you're in sales." "Fucking sales," Lennox thinks. "What is this?" "Yeah. Me too," Lance smiles, eliciting a giggle from Starry. "Huh, but I guess this fella ain't the same type of salesman as you," Johnny laughs. "I guess he probably ain't," Lance Deering says in mock sorrow. "But then again, I reckon that there might just be two types of salesmen, good and bad. Ain't that right, Ray?" Lennox remains silent, Starry's capricious grin telling him it was them she had talked to on the phone earlier. Their presence is certainly a surprise to Robin, and not, it seems, a pleasant one. Lennox moves away, sits down on the settee. Silence is always the best way, he's found, in such situations. His eyes scan around the room, always seeming to wind up back at Robin's hips, legs or arse. He's aware that he wants to fuck her, but considers shamefully this is probably just because the opportunity has receded with Lance and Johnny's presence. But now anyone will do. Something has gone off behind his cock. Instead, he chops out another line from the big rock in the larger packet that Starry has placed on the table, all the time on edge against the kid reappearing, and he takes it down. He looks at the print of a semi-nude woman on the wall. Then he considers Johnny and Lance again. The concern he felt at their intrusion has gone. His fear evaporating, he fancies kicking it off. Now all that's inside him is a black anger, still and even. He's not thinking of Brittany Hamill anymore, but he knows that when he does, he could kill anyone for her demise. And he feels like killing. Just hurting would be insufficient. His dark mood creeps through his veins like a poison. He knows these faces. Deering's mocking reptilian smile, Johnny's pudgy vacant stare. If only these men knew the danger they were in. He grinds his teeth till he imagines he hears the enamel crack, but he's a cop, abroad. Calm the fuck down. So he goes to the kitchen and gets another beer from the fridge. Dull these coke rushes. Robin follows him. He wants to fuck her and kill the rest of them. Even Starry, especially Starry. Something about her has disturbed him. That protean presence, 1 minute sexy, the next malign and controlling. She changed when those guys came in. He could feel it, see in her eyes. Maybe it was a coke, it was good stuff, not too chemical. Maybe it was because he was doing all her gear. He worries about offering her some cash, feels a wad of 20s in his pocket. He can't think laterally. His thought pattern is linear, like a high-speed locomotive careering towards one destination. All he can do to stop this is to take more coke. It helps. You can outrun your thoughts. He heads back into the living room. Robin's still pursuing him, ranting something about star signs, and lifts up the copy of Perfect Bride. The lines he'd hidden from the kid are intact. Starry moves over and augments them for Lance and Johnny. They're nothing now, the other three. No sense of threat, just a source of drugs. A defiant sense of entitlement fuses him. On holiday. Starry has another big bag of the stuff. A big rock. It might be a long night. A long, long night that lasts half an hour. He recalls that he would sit up near the toilet in the Grapes, the Young Coppers bar back in Edinburgh, or up in somebody's flat, often his, snorting and boasting about how they had put away this cunt and threatened that cunt and done this cunt and would get that fucking bastard. The real vitriol was not reserved for the criminals, though, but the bosses, senior police officials, local and national politicians. It was these spastics that fucked up everything, that fucked up the job. Lennox has done what he refers to as a rehab thing, and still goes to regular NA meetings. He knows how the drug presses you like a wild flower into something resembling yourself, but a one-dimensional representation of it, jagged and volatile, all sneers and jeers, pushing back your boundaries of verbal and physical and sexual violence. She was just a fucking kid. Wee Brittany. Just a bairn. You have to stop thought. The line goes up his nose. Brittany's face dissolves, becomes the attractively sluttish woman opposite him. Robin. The cloying, irritating, girlish voice somehow grows sexy. A southern belle, Scarlett O'Hara to his wrecked butler, way down in Alabama. Milky tones inquiring. Y'all want to go lie down for a while, honey? And Lennox knows that even feeling like fucking the world, it will take extremity, violent perverse extremity, to make his floppy penis anything like hard enough to do the job. In a bit, he says, charging his glass with a bottle of vodka, he feels trapped in a skanky vortex of his own making. And Lance Deering has now swooped down to rant at him, ostensibly telling him about fishing, but Lennox knows the charged power of words and cocaine, and that Deering is trying to establish presence, power and dominance. Pulled a big old bastard out of the sea yesterday. Took a while, and I thought he'd bust a line at one point, but I stayed on his ass. That was the thing, I stayed on his ass. Sucker was going nowhere once he'd bitten on a my hook. So Ray Lennox kicks back with a skinny smile on his lips and gives monosyllabic answers. As he looks into this man's leathery face, watches the spittle shoot from the corner of his mouth, he feels nothing now. He neither likes nor dislikes Lance. How can he? They're strangers on cocaine, grinding their teeth, obstacles for each other to navigate, Formula One drivers trying to go around traffic cones at high speed. They rant in short bursts at each other in an ugly intimacy, each exposing the same raw nerve of ego to the other. Then Lance gets up to dance with Robin, who obviously fears him, and a smiling starry as Lennox considers his lot. He can't marry Trudy. If they were ever going to get married, then they would have been by now. He met her when he was 18, when she was 18 and he was 27. 8 years ago, he'd just got his second big promotion. Detective Inspector Lennox. He'd be the youngest chief constable in Scotland. They'd only half joked. But after that, nothing. Treading water, snorting more cocaine. And he and Trudy had split up. 3 years later, though, they started going back out together. He had come back from Thailand and was cleaning up, going to the NA, was back at the kickboxing. They met at a new gym he was trying out. Unbeknown to him, she was a member. A coffee, catching up. Both free agents. The spark, still there. Catching up. Dinner, a film, coffee, bed. Catching up. The sex, it was better than ever before. Trudy now a sleek, confident mid-20s gym rat rather than a slightly pudgy teenager. Him, a sober shagging machine, the carnal obsession dominating everything. Shrugging aside the words of several guys on the force, reheated cabbage, beware, bad move. But she loved him. She loved him because he was a lost cause and her own vanity was strong enough to convince her that with her brand of tough love, Ray Lennox, Project Lennox, could be successfully realised. He could become a superannuated superman, a breeder of good Scottish Protestant children who would excel, not just academically, but at the BBs and the school sports and be model citizens of the world, as the Scots always were. Or at least the ones designated for export. Trudy saw how he'd changed. Matured was the term she frequently used. The first time she'd touched him again was to run her finger down his nose. "It's bent a little," she'd said. "Accident in Thailand. Broke it," he'd explained, looking into her eyes. That was what made me give up the gear. I realised what I was doing, what I'd lost. She liked what she saw, but she'd seen what she wanted to see. He was a mess, affecting a seen-it-all blasé front when his insides were like chopped liver. Cool Lennox with the shredded nerves. Sometimes punching and kicking the bags helped, sparring with the gloves, building up the strength, speed and confidence that came with it. Earning the swagger, knowing that other men sensed that it wasn't empty, that there was something behind it. Sometimes, though, when something really bad happened, only talk helped. But at Edinburgh, you only talked and drank, and cocaine helped you drink and talk longer. The Brittany Hamill case was at something bad. Soon, he was struggling at the NA, scrambling and sweating half-heartedly at the gym. Every time he flipped through the register with all these nonce faces he wanted to deal with, he wanted coke more than ever. "Come on, honey," Robin says, cutting to the chase in frustration. "I want to fuck." Her savage desperation reminding him of the stripper in Fort Lauderdale, or Trudy even. "Does that sound so bad? So selfish?" Lennox thinks, "Aye, it does, you fucking hingout. Your wee lass is in the next room." "No, but I don't want to shag you. I mean," he stalls, grimly savouring the power of rejection for a beat. "I can't. I've had too much coke." Robin steers a fearful glance at Lance and Starry, locked in a flirtatious Latin dance. With their swampy grimaces and scornful whispers, they seem to be conspiring to destroy them both. Meanwhile, Johnny sits in the armchair, broody and splenetic, his eyes bulleting out bad vibes. Lennox looks at Robin's shrunken, haunted face. "Let's just go next door and lie down a little," she whispers in an undisguised plea. "I need to be with someone, Ray. I'm fucked. My life has just gone to shit. I don't know what I'm going to do. If it wasn't for Tiana, she's the only good thing I've done in my goddamn miserable, fucked up life." She hasn't realized that her voice has picked up and that the others have been listening to the exchange. "That sounds real fun," Starry mocks. "A professional victim and a guy who can't fuck her." "Why, you little sweet talker, you." Lance rolls his eyes and Johnny laughs heartedly. It's now officially a house divided. "Why?" Robin squeals as she tugs Lennox on his bad hand, compelling him to follow her to the door. "Do people have to be mean like that? Why? It's fucking cruel." "Oh, spare us," Starry snaps in disdain. Lennox hears her laugh. "She'll be back when she needs more blow." "I reckon about 20 minutes from now," Lance adds in sagely mocking tones. Lennox finds himself being led away from the bag of coke, the source of his power. How we love what kills us. He's still everywhere but where it matters as Robin drags him onto the bed, her skirt ridden up, revealing a flesh-coloured thong emblazoned with the slogan, "I have the pussy, I make the rules." She tears his garment to the side, exposing a thick tuft of pubic hair like a punk mohawk, and kisses him on the mouth. He catches the dirty, foul, stale tobacco on her breath, feels his own jaw clamping. Robin pulls away from his tight, unyielding lips and lies back on the bed. By the light, he sees her jawbone sink into her face, melting into the obscene, bloated flesh of her neck that seems to have appeared from nowhere, making him think of that exotic frog with its shocking, instantaneous expanse of throat. Lennox is frozen, an inset in the proximity of those hypnotic, bulging eyes. So she springs back up and she's on him, unzipping him, her hand inside his trousers and pants, her urgent fingers, asking him the same question repeatedly without getting the reply they crave. A yawn of exhaustion bubbles up through the cocaine rushes. Lennox tries to stifle it, but it tears free from his face, almost sending his jaw into a spasm. He can hear Robin panting desperately, "Sexy, sexy boy, sexy boy." It's probably not that long after midnight, yet he can sense next morning's dawn spinning relentlessly over him from space. A glance at Robin reveals her eyes still protruding like a mad scientist. "I can get you going, Ray. I know what you guys like." She lurches over to the bedside locker and produces a pair of fur-lined handcuffs from a drawer. "We can do anything you want. You want to fasten me to the bed? We can do anything you want." Robin is cut short as a terrified shriek fills the air. It doesn't stop. Robin's first thought is that it sounds like a child. Then both he and Robin realise it's her daughter. She's screaming. Lennox zips up and runs towards the noise, with Robin following. Thank you so much for listening, folks. Even got dramatic sound effects there. So.
So let me start by asking you, why bring back Ray?
Yeah, I mean, he was a sort of sidekick character in Filth, and I sort of thought that I was looking for somebody who would kind of fit the bill to be this stranger in a strange land who was kind of solving this crime. And he had to be a character of secrets, and Lennox seemed to be a character of secrets. I mean, when I wrote Filth, I couldn't quite work out why he was a cop. You know, he didn't seem to be like a cop in a lot of ways, and there seemed to be a lot more to come from him. And when I thought about a backstory, I mean, it had to be somebody who was quite resourceful, you know, to function in this kind of environment, but somebody, you couldn't have been a cop in, from Chicago or New York or something, because he would have had the contacts just to go straight to the police. He had to be somebody who would be, who could go on the run, but could also have the potential to sort this out. And he had to be a character of secrets, basically. So I kind of thought about the backstory for him, what his backstory might be, and he kind of fitted the bill.
So the story didn't evolve from the character then. You had a sort of idea of what kind of story you wanted to write, and then you found the character to fit the story.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was that I wanted to write something about, you know, living in Ireland. I mean, I live in Dublin, in Ireland most of the time, and you can't really pick up a newspaper or sort of or watch a TV program there without some kind of child sex abuse old case coming up, you know, from people taking action against paedophile priests from way, way back. You know, it just happened with the Celtic Tiger and the demise of the power of the church. And there's all sorts of, all these stories keep coming out, and there's all these kind of lawsuits that keep appearing. And it's just, you know, the scale of it's kind of has emerged as being quite horrific there. And it's kind of gone on for years. And the, you know, the whole country is just coming to terms with that. And so I think that was quite, you know, was quite a big influence for me. And I realised, though, that when I started to research this, I realised that kind of paedophilia was a really boring thing to write about. You know, it really is. It's, you know, it's really boring, and paedophiles are really boring, because, and the reason it's boring because there's absolutely no moral ambiguity about it at all. I mean, we're all agreed that it's wrong and it's evil, and then they're very wrong, and it's because of that there's kind of no dynamism to it. I mean, even things like drugs or violence or whatever, you can say that they're part of a societal or individual kind of, you know, the fabric about what we are to some extent. So there is a bit of this ambiguity and this discussion around it, you know, but there's nothing around this. So it doesn't really make for interesting writing. So to me, it had to be a more positive book. It had to be about how people actually heal themselves, you know. And kind of most of my writing is about why people mess up, and how we mess up, and how we make the wrong decisions in life, which compound the kind of problems and the kind of punitive kind of world we live in. How we actually make things worse for ourselves, and this is actually how we make things better for ourselves when bad things have happened to us. And I think when I started to research it, I started to go around some of the survivors' groups. I was quite moved by the kind of the courage that people had shown that had come through sexual abuse at an early age, and that so many of them had gone on to do really positive things with their lives. So we kind of I think that kind of changed the whole. You know, I felt I couldn't. You know, I didn't write the book that I thought I would write. It became a very different book.
What was the book you thought you would write?
I wanted to write something that about the subject that was. When I read Nabokov's Lolita, I get very angry because it's a great work of fiction, but I hate the way that it's still lionized, because now we know it's almost saying that if somebody's this upper middle class kind of high aesthete type of person, it always gives them kind of permission to abuse children. And I think obviously Nabokov's writing in different times, and we know now the devastating effect it has on people's lives, that kind of abuse. But I was writing against this idea that that there's certain people who are kind of exalted, that, you know, if you're a kind of a 50-year-old pop star, you know, you can take young boys into bed, but if you're a 50-year-old truck driver, it becomes a whole different thing. It's looked as a whole different thing. So I just wanted to have a book that didn't have that kind of ambiguity about it. But I think the way it changed was about the relationship between Lennox and Tiana, the young girl, and the way he helped her, but also the way she helped him to come to terms with something that he'd been repressing about his past, and that as long as he'd been repressing it, he'd been going down this route of going to NA and AA and all that, and kind of tackling the kind of effects rather than the cause. You know, so he'd repressed the cause of it, and she's kind of helping him to come to terms with that. So it is about, it became about how people heal rather than, because how people get messed up just didn't really interest me in this, because it was just so unambiguously evil. I just felt the book couldn't really be about that.
Right. They have a really interesting relationship, Lennox and Tiana, and it's interesting because it's complicated by this whole notion of pedophilia that runs throughout the book. I mean, even though that's not what their relationship is about, there's a scene where he, you know, he's taking her somewhere to try and take her to safety. I'm trying to give away as little of the plot as I can, but they have to spend the night in a hotel, and he gets very concerned about perception, right? They get two separate rooms, and he's worried about how things are being perceived, and he's very aware of kind of keeping this distance, almost hyper-aware. And I thought that that was a really interesting thing. And at the same time, a lot of lines get blurred between sort of adult and child, father figure, daughter figure, friendship, etc. I'm curious about how that relationship developed as you were writing the book.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to get the idea that, I mean, because she's been abused as a kid, and because she's kind of, her mother's kind of, all, you know, because of the abuse and because of the behavior of her mother and all that, she's kind of been inappropriately sexualized, and so she represents this kind of she represents jeopardy for him as well, you know. So, and he has to kind of get to find her humanity and to, you know, to basically kind of give her the permission to be a kid again, basically. So that's the way the relationship kind of that's the way the relationship develops. And for him to do this, he has to kind of, you know, it kind of has taken him back to when he was a kid, and, you know, there's a terrible thing that happens to him as a kid that he's kind of repressed, and which is a lot of it is, you know, the key to his subsequent behavior. So I think that they both kind of unlock this, they both solve this puzzle for each other, basically.
It seems to me, too, that their relationship is where the moral ambiguity you're talking about really enters into the book. You're right that, I mean, for many of the sort of antagonists of the book, there is no moral ambiguity. But because she's sexualized against her will, but nonetheless, that's sort of what she's learned, she becomes a kind of complex, contradictory, even in some unwitting way, complicit character. And because of his own background and his own obsessions, he's also complex and complicit in various ways.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, they're very dangerous to each other, and they shouldn't, you know, the whole point of the story is that they shouldn't really be in this position. They shouldn't be together, basically. And I mean, it's like kind of, I mean, no adult should be with a child that they don't have responsibility for, and no, you know, nobody should be put in his position to have to take responsibility for a kid in this way. And it's, you know, the book is kind of, you know, the narrative of it is fueled by that desperation and that kind of jeopardy that to the outside world, this justifiably kind of seems to be a very dangerous thing. And he only has to take her kind of maybe about 3 hours across to the Gulf of Mexico, but it kind of, you know, it becomes the sort of longest, it stretches out from 3 hours but into a couple of days through circumstances, but becomes probably, you know, the longest couple of days and the most hazardous couple of days in his life, and potentially the most hazardous in hers as well, because, you know, there's a sense that they're being pursued by other people too.
Right. I'm curious about the time frame. It's a very compressed time frame. The main action of the book takes place within about 48 hours. Was that always part of the plan? Did you think about having it stretched out further? What are the advantages for you in terms of, as a writer, telling this story in such a compressed time?
I think the thing is that it kind of makes more sense of kind of his behavior, because I don't think that no matter how messed up he was, he would see it as appropriate for holding on to a kid for any longer than that. They didn't have any responsibility for. He would find somebody else to leave her in charge with, even with the sense of kind of jeopardy. So I think it had to take place within a very short but intense time frame, and to have that kind of filled with kind of jeopardy and incident, and to have the narrative sort of drive on. And it's like, I mean, I tried to make it operate as a thriller, you know, on two levels. You know, the idea that there is this kind of clear and present danger to the both of them, but It's also a kind of, I think it's more of an existential thriller, because it's about Lennox trying to find out what's gone on, he's trying to solve the mystery of himself, really, at the same time as he's trying to solve the mystery of how he's got himself in this, you know, immediate position. And it's like, it's not just to do with her, it's also to do with him, that he's kind of, through his work, but also through his own past, he senses this kind of thing in people. He almost senses this kind of danger. He senses this sort of thing. And for him, it's to try and work out how much of it is his own paranoia and how much of it is his own mental breakdown and how much of it is, you know, that his senses are so attuned to this type of crime that he can see it almost before it happens.
It's interesting you say that, because I think one of the things that's compelling about the book is exactly that sense of Lennox, and not only Lennox, other characters too, their own paranoia or their own kind of inability, or I guess let's say the difference between what they're perceiving and what may or may not actually be happening, the way that their perceptions kind of sometimes get in their way. I mean, Lennox is an extreme example. He's always sort of trying to read the situation and suspicious of everyone. I'm curious too about that as a kind of, both as a character thing, but also as a narrative device.
I think it's a kind of device in general. But I mean, I know I'm sure it's the same in the UK. But one of the horrible things about paedophilia, apart from what it does to the people who are direct victims, it also kind of reduces and debases us all, because it kind of it turns the most liberal of us into kind of sort of lynchers and all. You know, we kind of feel our own kind of debasement, and there's no other way that, in some ways, there's no other way we can kind of behave. It makes everybody paranoid and edgy. And I mean, there was a thing in Britain when they first started to publish a register of sex offenders. You had a mob, I think it was in Portsmouth, that they kind of broke into this house and they beat up somebody who was suspected of being a sex criminal, and they were actually a paediatrician. You know, and it's just you know, the hysteria kind of you know, it isn't helpful either, but it's kind of inevitable given the sheer emotive power of the subject. So I wanted to kind of make Lennox this kind of confused everyman character who just really sort of he has all these kind of instincts about it, and he also has his own kind of agenda as well.
It's true. I mean, the notion that it makes us all edgy and uncomfortable, I mean this is high praise, actually, but my stomach hurt the entire time I was reading this book. And it made me kind of squirmy in an edgy sort of way. I think partly that had to do with certainly with the pedophilic content, and also with kind of the claustrophobia of the two of them together. You often deal with not with this particular extreme, but those kinds of extremes with books and stories that sort of push your readers in a certain way and make them squirm.
I think I tried to get a reaction from myself, and one of the things that, you know, when I found I was going to the survivors groups, and you know, when people start telling you, you know, kind of often quite, you know, people of all different age groups, quite advanced years, you know, some people, and they're telling you about the things that have happened to them and these terrible, terrible things. It's like, and when you're sitting there, you're hearing people telling you the story, and you've asked them to tell you, and it becomes a cathartic thing for them. So you have to listen, but you want to be anywhere else but in that kind of room. And I wanted to get a sense of that in the writing, the occasions when Lennox is when she's telling Lennox about what's happened to her, and this kind of this horrible kind of feeling that it's just so awkward, and so, you know, we don't have the emotional vocabulary really to deal with that, to listen to that. And one thing that I did realise was that the people who work with people who've been sexually abused, you know, and with paedophiles, I mean, I've got complete sort of and utter respect for them, because to actually have to go in, I know they're trained and they're, you know, they get all kind of sensitivity training and, you know, all that kind of stuff, but to actually have to go in and do that day after day, I mean, I just think that would be such an absolutely kind of terrible job. I mean, I could type in a few pages, and if it got too much for me, I could walk away and forget about the book and do something else for a bit and come back to it. But they can't. They've got to go in day after day and, you know, go through all this.
How much research did you do?
Well, I mean, I didn't do any research on the internet for obvious reasons. I mean, I didn't kind of...
we'd be talking to you through a plexiglass wall.
You would be talking to me through plexiglass now. But I think, again, it's like I just didn't have any interest in sort of encountering even accidentally kind of child pornography or anything like that, or kind of, you know, getting into anything to do with that. But, so everything I did kind of, I did through library research work, and I kind of got in touch with social workers, clinical psychologists and practitioners and all that kind of sort of mental health and sexual offenders field. And basically it was quite involved, but it was interesting. It was interesting to get all the views of people, who are actually practitioners in the field and who are working. You're just working in this really kind of sort of difficult and desperate area, but it was kind of one of the things that it did do, I think it made the book much more upbeat, and strangely given the subject matter, I think it's probably the most positive book I've written, because it does have a very upbeat and positive kind of conclusion, really. And I think that one of the things that is like that, but I noticed that, I think because they reckon that like 70% of paedophiles have been abused themselves, we sometimes get the impression that everybody who's sexually abused, runs the risk of becoming a paedophile and all that, which is only a very small amount of people do, and so many people kind of get over it. And I was quite inspired by the way that people actually do come back from these terrible things. And it's like that old kind of Nietzschean dictum about, what doesn't sort of kill you makes you stronger. And you saw that in a lot of cases, that people did become really kind of good and effective citizens and good members of the community. A lot of people, social work, police, education, have come through that that experience. And, people tend to be attracted to these jobs just because they can help other people, and they can recognise that pain that other people have had.
I also wanted to ask you about the police research and just sort of the kind of mechanisms of the thriller, let's say. Was there research, what kind of research was involved in sort of those kind of constructions?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to police officers in Chicago and in Miami, and I mean, it's like police officers are kind of, they're like anybody else. They're very helpful if they know. If they know you're a novelist, I mean, it's like the victims of survivors of sexual abuse. I mean, if they think you're a journalist, it's like kind of no way. But if they know you're a novelist and you're not interested in kind of putting their experience down or exposing their experiences, then they're happy to talk to you. If they know that, they know that if a novelist, you're really interested in the emotional thing, you're interested in the kind of broad brush, you're not really interested in the details, as journalists would be. So I think that once people know that, and I think certainly people like police officers and social workers always find that everybody likes talking about their job. If you take people out for lunch or a beer, they'll talk kind of very, very readily about their job, and provided they realize that you're going to respect their anonymity, which you always do.
Now, I mean, I'm interested about the decision to write. I mean, in many ways, this is a pure thriller. Filth had thriller components to it, but it also had some more phantasmagoric components to it. And but this is really the first pure thriller. Was there a conscious decision to, and in that sense it's a departure, was there a conscious decision on your part to move into writing a pure thriller? Was this just sort of, or was this just sort of an organic part of the writing and the way the book developed?
I think I was more consciously interested in writing, not so much writing the traditional thriller, but wanting to kind of keep the pages turning, wanting to kind of entertain, to put a bit of suspense into there, because I think that it's quite a disturbing subject matter, and I felt that when I was writing it, I didn't want to spend too much time dwelling on the kind of on the horror of it. Really, I wanted to have a page turner so it would be entertained, and the pages would keep kind of flying by. And that's I think as a reader as well, writers are always readers, and if I was reading something like that, that I would find that I'd rather read something that was an issue like that. I'd rather read it in a textbook, in an academic textbook, than I would do, you know. So, you kind of want to, you want to make it kind of move. You want to make the narrative move so that people aren't kind of necessarily dwelling on the negative aspects of it, which, you know, they're obviously it's very negative, but they can also see that you're moving the narrative towards a positive place. Right. So I think that was kind of quite important to me to do that.
I mean, and in terms of what you're saying about A Stranger in a Strange Land, I mean, I'm curious about the decision to set it in the United States and to actually pursue that Stranger in a Strange Land. Does that have to do in any way, this is the critic thinking, does that have to do in any way with the idea of someone like Ray getting immersed into sort of the pedophilic underground, being a stranger in a strange land, and that it became even stranger to have him in a foreign country? Or was it just simply a result of you spending more time in the US and being interested in exploring it as a setting?
I think it was probably Miami, particularly because if you look at the kind of Miami's got a very kind of noirish kind of culture with regards to writing, and it is a kind of, I mean, there's probably nothing that kind of, there's nothing really probably more horrible that happens in Miami than happens in Berlin or Edinburgh or whatever, but because of the culture, you can conceive of it more readily is happening there, because it's such a bright and sort of vibrant tropical place, but because it's there's so many kind of quite, it's a lot of rootless displaced people there. You get people coming in from South and Central America. It's like the new Ellis Island, basically, or like LA was like 50 years ago. It's the point of embarkation for kind of new Americans, and it's also for people living in America. It's like I think it was like Andre Dubas in his new book, he described it as like, if you tip America on its side, everybody who's not tied down in a job or a relationship, they basically all fall down into Florida.
Right. That's what Frank Lloyd Wright said that about Southern California too, that if you tip America, all the loose screws end up in Southern California.
It seems to be true, and I think because of that, there's not the kind of the civic culture that you would get in, say, the northern cities like the New York boroughs or in Chicago or Boston or whatever. You know, people don't really feel connected with the city in the same way. There's not the culture that they're kind of looking after it. So it feels a bit kind of rootless and a bit of a frontier town in a lot of ways. So it just was possible. It seemed to be more possible to conceive of that kind of thing happening there than it would be in, you know, perhaps other places. And it's also such a kind of vibrant, exciting place, and I spend a lot of time there. And, you know, I have done for about 10 years. I've started going there with the Winter Music Festival, and I've kind of been going there ever since, really. So it just seemed to be a great place to set something like that.
And does that also give you a sense of, I mean, both the kind of vibrancy of the city, but also kind of pulling out of your natural environment as a writer, give you a kind of freedom or a sense of play in some way that you wouldn't, might not have?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I kind of, it's such a bright place, you know. I mean, if you come from Scotland, which is always dark and cold, and you go there, you actually just feel the kind, your kind of synapses kind of open and exploding, you know, and you think, this is great, you know. It is, it's like kind of, you get off, you know, when I fly to Scotland, from Scotland, and I get off for Ireland, and I get off in Miami International Airport, and I step outside in the sun, it's just like kind of, it's like taking a kind of, it's like going back to sort of 1988 and taking a big strong hit of ecstasy and just going, whoa, man, this is fantastic. So, I mean, it just has that sort of great energizing kind of feel to it, you know. I think my spine kind of goes straighter instantly. It's just such a great experience for me. So I kind of think that it has a kind of, you know, the actual sun and the climate has a sort of medicinal effect on Lennox as well.
Well, you know, Frank McShane, who was a biographer of Raymond Chandler, said that one of the great things about the noir novel or the mystery or the thriller was that the cop or the detective gave you a way to write about every strata of society, because he or she had entree, right? You could write about the rich and the poor and the middle class, and it crossed all borders. And that's clearly something that happens here. I mean, Ray ends up in a variety of different settings and gets a big cross-section. I'm curious about your sense of that as a writer and the importance of getting that three-dimensional or multi-tiered portrait of society.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of felt a bit, to be honest, I mean, I'm not a great fan of like the police procedural kind of crime novel. It doesn't really do that much for me. I'm much more interested in the existential thriller when it's very character-based and very psychological. But I did feel a wee bit kind of, a wee bit shabby kind of making him a cop, because it is a kind of, as you say, there is that entree, there is that kind of, it is a kind of cheap and nasty way of getting somebody into all different places. It is like a kind of, you know, like going into a nightclub and access all areas type of pass thing, you know. And I think, you know, is there a kind of way that I could have made him something else, or I could have made the main character something else? And I did kind of rack my brains. And I did feel a wee bit kind of, I did feel a wee bit scabby and kind of low-life making him a cop, you know, it seemed a bit kind of broad strokes, but I just couldn't really think of any other way of getting him into all that, I mean, it had to be somebody that was resourceful enough to be able to kind of navigate his way around all this stuff, and, you know, had to have that kind of experience.
When you say existential thrillers, what do you mean? I mean, or which ones do you mean?
I mean, you know, like the, you know, your kind of, I would say just about kind of, well, I'm talking about really the, you know, the classic kind of European sort of literary novel, you know, like kind of, like Kafka, you know, and Metamorphosis. I see them as the kind of existential thrillers, and these are the ones that kind of, these are the kind of things that grip with me. I mean, there is police procedural stuff in here, because you can't really get away from it. It has to, you know, you have to have something in it, but it's not something that really can interest me greatly.
Well, I also think, I mean, one of the interesting things about the book is that it does have those existential stakes. You know, I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting about it is the way sports and kind of Ray's obsession with soccer or with the Hearts creates that. We have that great description of them almost winning the championship and then losing, and you refer to it as I just have to find it in my notes. Well, the sort of, I think what the line is, sort of the beauty and terror of being alive is what watching this team, the fans all watching the team lose together, that it's almost more profound an experience to lose, because ultimately that's what life is, as opposed to sort of the celebrating of the championship. And it's brilliant. I mean, anyone who's actually cared about a sports team and watched them snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory can relate to that. But it's fascinating, and it takes something that you think of as that culture tends to write off as trivial and makes it existential.
Yeah, I mean, it's something you kind of have experienced quite a lot in Scotland. Like if you follow Hibs or Hearts, or you know, I think it's like. One of the things that's interesting to me is, like, I mean, I think that victory doesn't really, you don't really learn anything from victory or success or whatever, because you just become a bit insufferable. You just want, you know, you just want to do the same thing again and all that. But it always comes in the same form, you know, whereas failure is much more interesting to me, because it comes in all these different forms. It comes in all these different kind of ways. And it's like, I mean, I've been to these kind of sporting occasions where people have kind of, you know, they've responded with anger, or they've responded with sorrow and all that. But this was just this thing when Hearts lost that league flag was quite an interesting thing, because a lot of Heart friends that are Heart supporters, a lot of them are there and all that, and it was just this weird kind of mood that spilled over, that they couldn't actually, something, you know, something really profound had happened, but they couldn't quite grasp what this was. You know, but they had to stay with each other. Everybody had to share this experience. You couldn't just say, "Oh, we lost this game, we lost the flag." It's, you know, we're pissed off, or to wreck the town that they were in, or whatever. You know, they just had to kind of almost just be, basically. You know, just be together and look at each other and say, "Well, Christ, what went on there?"
I wanted to ask you one last question, and then we'll turn it over to a few questions from the floor. Towards the end, at the very end of the book. And this won't give away any plot. You talk about He's thinking, I'll just read a quote. He's thinking of why we have stories, songs, and poems, why we'll always have aspirations for something we call love. And I was curious, I mean, this is part of the affirmative ending, but I wanted to ask you, why do you think we all will always have stories and songs and poems and those kinds of aspirations? And how does literature speak to those aspirations?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to kind of, I mean, I think it's just it's what we're about, basically. I mean, we do try and validate the joy of life. You know, that's kind of part of our, that's part of being human, and that's part of our kind of quest of being human, is to find ways of doing that. And we'll always do that, and that's our kind of, that's our saving grace, really, you know, for, in spite of all our kind of, you know, our kind of sort of, our possessive, imperialist, fascistic kind of tendencies and all that—that's just the saving grace that we do that. We do try and we do try and find joy in life. We do try and validate that through kind of through poems, through songs, through literature, through the just loving each other, basically. And that's, you know, that's what makes it great to be alive, really, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So I think we have about a few minutes to take some questions from the audience, and if you guys raise your hands, we'll call on you and wait till the microphone comes around.
Hi, thanks for a very interesting lecture. I've always loved your books, and what I really love about them is the weaving stories and how there's always surprises in them. And what I wanted to ask was, you were talking about you had the idea for this book and it turned into something else. How much, when you sit down to write, do you have the whole story mapped out, and how much of it is discovery on the way and involves rewrites, or in this case, coming up with a different type of book?
I think to me, it's like they've all been quite different, and I think it depends how much you have a story in your head first. And I mean, when I wrote a book called Marabou Stork Nightmares, and I had the story in my head for such a long time that, when I came to write it, you know, I basically drew out a rough plan of then when I came to write it, the whole thing took about 5 weeks to write. You know, it just flew out. But that's because I've been writing it in my head for so long. You know, when I committed it to paper, it kind of flew out. And the reverse of that would be when I wrote a book called Glue, which it was basically time that I gave the publisher another book and I had nothing to write about, and I thought, I wrote this story about these guys at the Munich Beer Festival, and just, you know, had them sort of just rapping away about the three of them rapping away about this other guy's foreskin, basically. And I thought, well, you know, this is you know, then just being these kind of smutty, kind of daft guys, and I thought, I'll age them 10 years and see what they're like. It was just like almost like a kind of crass creative writing exercise, you know. And then I thought, well, I'll put them 10 years younger and see what they were like, and then I'll put them 10 years younger from that and see what their parents were like, what kind of homes they grew up in, and so I wrote this big kind of this epic thing about kind of Edinburgh working class life, and it was much longer than a book that I feel comfortable writing. But again, it was a different thing, you know. You had to find the characters in the story from the blank page, really. You had to kind of hew them out of something in yourself rather than you had this kind of plan. So it just really depends. I mean, I think the material suggests itself, and I think a lot of it is how long you spend kind of percolating it and when you decide to commit to paper.
Sexual abuse by clergy in the United States has been suppressed for the decades and has exploded in the last 20 years. Would you comment on England and United Nations, United Kingdom? Is it still suppressed, or are you going through a similar dialogue?
I think there is this whole thing coming to light now, and I think that it happened a lot earlier in the UK. It kind of happened in the 80s in the UK, because Britain kind of has become an increasingly secular society. So the power of the church isn't as strong as it would be here in America or in Ireland. It's only in it's only in the last few years in Ireland that with, I think it was, it's with the affluence of the, you know, the Celtic Tiger economy, and with a lot of people, like educated people from Ireland coming back into, like, people that have lived and grown up in the States and in Europe and Australia and the UK, that have come back into Ireland with kind of different values, and that have kind of sort of questioned a lot of the stuff that's gone on there, that it's kind of blown the lid off this this massive, massive kind of issue. And I think it's because, like, the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland has been in a very unique position. It's almost the only religion there, and there's no separation between church and state still. So the responsibility, the power that the Catholic Church has had in education and housing and dealing with the most vulnerable people in the community has just been so powerful. And you know, and now it's come to light that there's just been so much abuse that's going on for so long. So, yeah, I mean, it's a huge, huge issue.
Other questions? We've got one over there.
Hello. When you were writing Trainspotting and it became a huge success, did you realise that you would then become like an ambassador for Scotland, and that from then on, you know, most Scottish people that go abroad are instantly greeted with, "Are you a heroin junkie?" Or...
No, I never really think about it in that sense. I mean, I don't, basically, you know, I think that the whole idea about kind of being an ambassador for Scotland kind of makes me cringe. You know what I mean? I'm not an ambassador for anybody. And I think that it's really interesting that there's just been this whole culture in Scotland, and it's this kind of whole kind of dependency culture, I suppose, about not being a kind of a fully fledged democracy, and about, you know, not being independent. So there is this kind of very infantile culture, not amongst ordinary people in Scotland, but amongst the kind of the supposed kind of opinion makers that you know, that should know better. That this very kind of prissy, what will the neighbours think of us type of thing, you know, it's a very self-conscious and very immature way of kind of looking at things. Because the basic thing is that the neighbours don't really give a fuck. I mean, they've got a lot more important things to kind of worry about than what people in some wee country in the sort of the Atlantic are doing. And the neighbours are usually England, and it's just, you know, it's this kind of, it's just a whole weird thing, you know, that, and I think one of the interesting things that has happened since Scotland, not only has its parliament, but has had a party that's kind of now ruling the country and is doing it in a much more kind of positive way, and is operating now as, as, in some ways, as an independent country. That there's been a lot of increase in the kind of level of maturity, that people realise that, you know, that because somebody writes a book about junkies in Edinburgh, not everybody is a junkie from Edinburgh any more than they're a kind of golf-playing, kind of shortbread-munching, sort of kind of haggis-eating, sort of kind of country gentleman, you know. And, you know, it's like kind of, I mean, kind of, it's as daft as thinking that, you know, anybody that... that because, say, Bret Easton Ellis wrote American Psycho, that everybody's a kind of serial killer in America. You know, it's just... I think that people in America wouldn't think that. I think the reason, you know, that we think, and we have that kind of view in Scotland sometimes, is that we don't have that... we don't have that sense of political maturity. It's always this kind of what will the neighbours think mentality. And I think we're kind of slowly beginning to come out of that now, thankfully.
Time for one more, so right up there.
How much does music influence your writing, and what would the soundtrack be for Crime?
I've always thought of Lennox as being a kind of early 90s kind of American sort of independent sort of kind of guy. Like, you know, I think he would listen to a lot of Red Hot Chili Peppers and kind of Foo Fighters and all that kind of stuff that I missed really when I was into sort of acid house at the time in the UK. But that's the kind of stuff that I think it would be kind of it would be a kind of soundtrack. But music is still a kind of big thing for me. I mean, I just came here after shooting a film in the UK and in South Wales, and I realised that practically the whole script and the whole film was kind of inspired by one song, which was a Scottish singer-songwriter Colin McIntyre's song "You're a Star" from his last album. So a whole kind of a whole film basically was generated from not just that one song, but a few others as well, and a few other ideas too. I think it was, you know, largely because I was, you know, the film is about it's a kind of Spinal Tap style mockumentary set in the world of British professional darts, you know, that kind of 180. So I mean, and it was nice and frivolous, and I was kind of writing it at the same time as I was writing this. So when this got kind of too heavy, I could go and sort of write my daft script about darts with my pal Dean Kavanagh, and it was great to be able to just finish the UK tour of this and then work on the staff darts movie and have a lot of fun, and then come back into here and, you know, to America and promote the book again.
Thank you all very much, and thank you, Irvine.
Thank you, folks. Thanks a lot.
Allowed Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Allowed theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.